Tom Reed with my personal radio column, It Seems to Me. And today, I'm going to be a listener like you. We have two outstanding guests, Dr. Rita J. Steck, who is a female MD in Southern California, and Jeffrey Bond, who is a evolutionary lifestyle anthropologist. Now, I'm going to sit and listen because Rita is going to host the program with Jeff, and I know it's going to be informative. Rita?
Thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate this opportunity to reach your listeners and hopefully educate and motivate them to be eating healthier. Now, it's not easy to eat healthy in America, and we'll get to that, but I'll just first mention Jeff Bond, as an anthropologist, is the one who taught me optimal human nutrition. I did not learn it in medical school. And so for many years, I did not have the appropriate information. Now, to make things even more difficult, just recently, in January of 2016, the HHS and USDA released some, quote, new dietary guidelines to encourage healthy eating patterns to prevent chronic diseases. So we're going to go into this a little bit because there's some good stuff here and I think some confusing information, and hopefully Jeff will help us sort that out. So what I was happy to see is that they are acknowledging that what we eat does affect our health, and we can prevent the chronic diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease and strokes. So let's look at what they're saying here. The first is healthy eating patterns should include a variety of nutritious foods like vegetables, fruits, grains, low-fat and fat-free dairy, lean meats, and other protein foods. So I will pause there and ask Jeff which of these he agrees with and which should not be used as healthy foods.
Well, yes, that's a very good question, Rita. And I think it opens up a deeper question, which I really would like to deal with first. And that is to say, what are these guidelines? Where do they come from and how do they arrive at them? And they do say about laws, in fact, I think it was Bismarck who said, it's not an edifying sight to see how laws are made or how sausages are made. And I think this is the same thing with these dietary guidelines. Every 5 years, they have to be revised. And I've been watching this process going on now since the year 2000, and it's not an edifying sight. That is to say, there's a panel of scientists who put forward their idea of what might be the scientific evidence for a good nutritious diet, healthy diet. But then it is put out for public comment, and then it has immense, all kinds of vested interests, lobbies weigh in with their own views. And of course, in the end, it's a political decision that decides ultimately what comes out. And so these guidelines are, in fact, a kind of a compromise between all the various competing interests and are not actually the gold standard for the way even the present scientific evidence stands, which is a great shame, because even if most perhaps of the American population have never heard of these dietary guidelines, they're nevertheless used to when they're designing school meals, institutional meals, hospital meals, and so forth. Dietitians and nutritionists have to learn about them and promote them. They become built into the official way of promotion of the kind of healthy lifestyle. Whereas, in fact, we know that there are certain things that are not great. Now, to answer your question, they talk about vegetables, fruits, yes, very good. And then they go on to talk about wholemeal grains. Yes, there's the fingers of the grain lobby all over this one. They talk about, what was the other one they were talking about?
Dairy.
Oh, dairy, yes, they're the fingers of the dairy lobby over there. Now, both of these, for various reasons, and we can get into, are not human foods. And we do know that they have huge drawbacks. And they are part of the reason why people in the Western world in general are suffering much from consuming these foodstuffs.
Thank you, Jeff, especially for bringing out the process by which these guidelines are formed. Unfortunately, it's not all science. There's, as Jeff said, that political overplay there, but that's another discussion. In the guidelines, it suggests, and I quote, including dark green, red, and orange legumes, which means beans and peas, and they specifically say starchy and other vegetables. Jeff, why should we not be eating starchy vegetables, which is mostly potatoes, corn? There's probably a few others as well.
All right, I have to back up a little bit because my background is coming from the idea that we're living in bodies and brains designed for life, totally different kind of life, in ancient times in the savannas of East Africa. And that our bodies and brains are still the same as for life back then, and that our bodies and brains are designed for the kinds of foodstuffs that were available back then and not for some of the new foodstuffs that have arrived into the food supply since then. And the rot really set in about 400 generations ago when human beings for the first time took control of their food supply and started farming. And when that happened, they started farming not necessarily what they would normally be eating, but what it was possible to farm and which would keep them alive. And it was at this point that, first of all, grains came into the diet. And these are, I sometimes call them bird seed, or they're certainly grass seed. And human beings aren't designed to be eating grass seeds. Broadly speaking, the main problems with them are manifold. First of all, they are starches. And starches are just sugar in another form, and they are sending our blood sugar levels sky high each time we consume them, which is creating all kinds of havoc in our biochemistry. Secondly, they contain various kinds of anti-nutrients that our bodies don't know how to handle. One of the big ones that we know about is gluten, and that people are becoming aware of that as a problem. Other ones are called lectins, alpha-amylase inhibitors, and many other kinds of plump poisons like that. You don't need to know the names particularly, but just know they're silently undermining our health in various kinds of ways. They're depressing human growth hormone. They're attacking pancreatic enzyme function. They're disrupting DNA maintenance, so your cells aren't getting maintained as they should be, more likely to be mutating, and so forth. So they're creating a lot of mischief in the background. Thirdly, they're not alkalizing. So whereas human beings should be eating a mildly alkalizing diet, grains are actually contributing to eating an acidic diet. So the bottom line on grains is, I sometimes say this, is that they're for the birds. Broadly speaking, we shouldn't be eating them. They're not human food. And then, of course, the next big thing that's come into the diet, and we kind of forget that we're unusual living in North America or Northwest Europe, and that is the consumption of the fluid from the mammary glands of lactating animals. That is to say, we're consuming cow's milk and sheep's milk. We need to sit back and think, well, wait a minute, why are we really doing this? We're consuming the milk of a species which isn't even right for the adult of the species, but we're feeding it to ourselves and to our kids. And we do know that there's problems with dairy. We do know there's problems with dairy, that it is a factor in a whole range of diseases, ranging from obesity to diabetes to cancers, to osteoporosis. It raises inflammation levels in the body, which is perhaps the underlying factor in a great many of its conditions, but also it is producing, it has all kinds of allergic reactions, it's got compounds in them that our bodies don't know how to handle. One of the famous ones, of course, now is lactose. We all know about the fat in milk that was brought out many years ago as perhaps being artery rotting, and that we're better off having skimmed milk, and you're beginning to wonder why we are still bothering with this stuff. And finally, the proteins in milk, the caseins and lactalbumins, are highly allergenic and are cholesterol-raising. So they're one of the factors that help us raise cholesterol levels when we don't need them.
Tom, I think you're going to get a lot of comments on Jeff's comments on whole grains and dairy, because I've noticed whenever I write an article that's published, I get all kinds of horror and negative feedback from dietitians and nutritionists who insist that whole grains are healthier. And so add another little point here, if you look at whole grain bread versus refined bread, yes, the whole grain bread is a little healthier because the nutrients that are in the kernel, you're getting those, but you're still getting all the starch and all those plant chemicals that are toxic to the human body. So, well, that's all I'll say on whole grains. We shouldn't be eating them. I also get a lot of flack on the dairy. And just to add one more comment on that, cow's milk, as Jeff said, is ideal. It is absolutely perfect for baby cows. Human children can get some benefit without toxicity up to about the age of 4. After that, they should not be eating or drinking, you know, any products from cow's milk. So let's go on to healthy oils. A lot of people, and unfortunately included in these guidelines, it's saying that any oil from a plant is good, whether it's corn oil, peanut oil, safflower, soybean, sunflower. And I'm going to ask Jeff to kind of describe why those are not healthy oils, but there are other oils that we should include in our diet.
Yes, of course, I'm being a little cynical and saying, well, fine, where the money is here. The devil is in the detail to do with fats and oils, and it's not an easy one to discuss because they try and skip over, it's very superficial, all this. But broadly speaking, human beings weren't going around plucking bottles of oil off trees or digging it up or anything like that. It just doesn't exist. It existed in a natural form in either plants or in the animals they were eating. And what we see is that, again, our bodies are designed for a particular profile of these fatty acids. We have to break it down past the point where we're talking about saturated fats or monounsaturated fats or polyunsaturated fats, down into the individual fatty acids that makes up. Now, one of the things we happened to us, and I certainly happened in my lifetime, is that we discovered that lard, which is a pork fat, is probably not terribly good for the arteries, and that we'd be better off eating something that is not pork fat. And stepped into the breach were the people who made vegetable oils. And so we've been consuming vegetable oils in ever-increasing quantities. The consumption has risen almost eightfold in about 50 years. And it's gone from being something that we could cope with very well to something that has become a problem to the diet. Now, when we talk about vegetable oils, we do need to break it down into which ones. And we have to then think in terms of what are the individual fatty acids in them. And what's happening today is that we're over-consuming a category of fatty acids called omega-6s, which are particularly present in corn oil, peanut oil, in safflower oil, in sunflower oil, and many others. All vegetable oils. But by over-consuming these, the body is then triggered into manufacturing hormones. And these are essential fatty acids, by the way, so the body needs them, but doesn't need too much of them. Because what it does is make powerful hormones called eicosanoids, which are, and in particular, the omega-6 series make inflammatory molecules. They make, which is again underlying all kinds of conditions, from cancers to osteoporosis to high blood pressure and so forth, and other kinds of hormones like thromboxanes, which increase blood clotting, and so on. So what this, so these particular oils are not actually great to be having in the diet either. And the challenge is we need to actually be stripping them out of the diet, because the other side of the balance are the famous omega-3 oils, which are notably present in fish oils, in the oily fish, the salmons, the sardines, trout, herring, that kind of fish. Or indeed one or two vegetable oils, such as canola oil or flaxseed oil or hemp seed oil. So there are a few vegetable oils that do fit the bill, but you do need to get into the detail. So there is the, in answer to that particular question, is a rather long-winded answer, but I hope if you've been able to follow it, that that gives you the guidelines where we need to be focusing your energies.
Thank you, Jeff. I think that's very important, though, because people are confused. You know, a bottle of corn oil, the marketer will put on the label gluten-free. Well, who would ever think there'd be gluten in it to begin with? But, you know, people think, oh, this is good. And they'll say vegetable. And so in people's minds, oh, I'm supposed to be eating more vegetables. So maybe an easier way to help remember this is remember which oils are the healthy ones. Canola, olive, avocado oil, flaxseed oil. Now, the downside to these oils is they're more expensive. The manufacturers are making, I don't know how many gallons of the other oils, the corn, the peanut, etc. But do try to use canola oil-based salad dressings. I found canola-based mayonnaise at the market. That's at Trader Joe's. But there is the cost factor to trying to eat healthy in America. So when you can, try to get these healthier ones. So I guess to wind up on the guidelines, don't get too overwhelmed by them. Politically, they're used for school menus, hospital menus, etc. But I think if you just remember the things we talked about here, that you want to avoid sugar and starch. So starchy vegetables are not healthy vegetables. Grains are for the birds and the healthy oils. So this is not something that's not in these guidelines is things like chia seed. Now, when I started eating healthy and trying to follow Jeff's guidelines and recommendations, and we'll tell you in a few minutes about his book, I really missed bread. I mean, bread is what we like the taste. We like the feel of it in our mouth. You know, we like making sandwiches with it. And I was still craving bread. Well, thank goodness, Jeff's wife, Nicole Bond, developed some recipes that use ingredients like almond flour. So you simply get raw almonds, put them in your food processor, grind them down into a flour-like substance, and you use that to make bread, a healthy bread. So you get a similar texture to a whole grain bread. I find it much tastier, and it's easier to eat healthy once you start looking for the healthier alternatives that are out there. Now, I just want to briefly mention, many of you may have heard of Michael Pollan. He's written a number of books. His latest one is In Defense of Food. When I first heard of it, I thought, whoa, that's an interesting title. And so, Jeff, what's your opinion as to whether or not we need to defend food?
Well, perhaps that's an opportunity just to back up a bit on the guidelines, on these USDA guidelines, because I think one of the interesting points they do make, these new guidelines, by the way, have moved away from the formula they had in the previous ones, where they're trying to be less prescriptive, as to say you will eat 5 teaspoonfuls of this and 3 ounces of that, to saying, look, in general, and this is one of the points I want to make, they say eat stuff which is nutrient dense. Now, that is code for saying eat your salads, fruits and vegetables. And stop eating quite so much starch, actually, is what they're trying to say there. And, of course, that aligns itself with what I'm trying to what I say too. And, yes, we're supposed to get our nutrients from foods. That's how it's been down through the ages. And it worked perfectly well right up until the present, well, the last few decades, when we suddenly thought we could micromanage what we do. We could eat any old rubbish and then try and compensate for the fact that it's all nutrient poor, and that's one of the other problems with grains, by the way, is that they're micronutrient poor. One of the reasons why we're micronutrient deficient is that we're eating too much in the way of grains and starches in general. yes, we need to be getting out all these micronutrients from food, because they have to be operating. There's tens of thousands of them. It's not just the vitamins and minerals. It's all the phenols and bioflavonoids and so forth. And they need to be working in harmony with each other in ways that we don't fully understand, but we do know that they work if you actually have the food, whereas if you try and micromanage it and dose on one or two of these things, it doesn't work. For example, we know that people who are have good micronutrient status recover well from cancers or don't get cancers, whereas if you try and give them the antioxidants that they think are doing the good job, like the vitamin D or the vitamin E or the vitamin C, it doesn't work. They need to be working in symbiosis with all the other things that are in the food. So, yes, absolutely, we need to be eating food, not supplements, and certainly not the ones that are micronutrient poor.
Now, this might sound almost silly, but we may need to define food. Because when you go into the grocery store, there are aisles and aisles and aisles of, quote, food. But once you start reading the label and see, well, yeah, this can of tomatoes, yeah, there's tomatoes in there, but there's also sugar and salt and preservatives. And my rule of thumb is if you're reading a label and there's something that's more than three syllables long in it and you have no idea what it is, you probably shouldn't be eating it. So by food, we mean what our great-grandmothers would recognize as food. Obviously, the produce section and the fish counter and an occasional visit to the meat counter. So as much as possible, what you put in your mouth should be exactly as Mother Nature produced it and not canned, etc.
Sorry, yes, I was butting in there. Just to say, a good rule of thumb is if most of your food is where you buy it doesn't have labels at all, that means it's not been messed around with any kind of way. So you buy a bag of apples or a bag of oranges, it doesn't have a food label. Yeah. It just tells you that it's got apples in there. And so as soon as you start getting into foods that have labels, well, yeah, you've got to start remembering you're in a jungle. It's a dangerous place, and you've got to start having the skills to survive in this jungle, which includes being able to read the tiny print on the ingredient label and then deciding whether what's in there is going to be right for you.
What frequently surprises me, in fact, I should say always surprises me, I'll see a counter of nutrient bars, protein bars, power bars, and I'll think, gee, I should probably just have one of these in my purse, so if I suddenly get a hunger attack, I'll have something healthy. But then I read the label, and it's anything but healthy.
I think you've put your finger on an important point there, that that we should always be making allowance for the possibility that we will be out and caught short, and that we should always be having with us some little snack or other which we can be safe with, and that can be a boiled egg or a bag of nuts or something like that, just so that we don't rush into buying something that is and be obliged to buy something that's unhealthy. The other point I would quite perhaps come back on, and that's this, that today the average Westerner, American, spends something like 6 or 7% of their income on food. Back in when I was a young man, it was 30 or 40% of the family's budget went on food. What we're saying to people is, look, we're not asking you to spend a whole lot more on food, but just think about that. You know, your priorities are what you spend your money on. We're asking you to shift it from 5 or 6% to 7 or 8% and make all the difference to your health.
Very good point. If we can spend $6 for a cup of coffee with who knows what has been added to it, we can certainly buy some fresh greens. So before we run out of time here, Jeff, I do want to tell people about your book, Deadly Harvest.
Right.
This book is extremely well researched. It's very readable. It's actually a textbook, so it's not an easy sit down and read in one evening. But all the things we've talked about and much, much more are in it. So I would encourage you to go to his website. And being British, his name is spelled G-E-O-F-F, Jeff Bond. So just Google in jeffbond.com. And he very generously put his entire book on his website. However, it's kind of difficult to read that way. So it is available through, I believe, Amazon.
Yes, and it's on Kindle too.
So it's because there's so much confusing information out there, and sometimes it comes to us from what seems a reliable source. I think we all need something we can check back to and say, well, let's see what Jeff said about this, because he truly is a meticulous researcher. And maybe as a final comment, I like what Michael Pollan said, eat food. Not too much, mostly plants. That kind of sums it up.
Yes, that's very good.
to keep it real simple.
Rita, in the last about 45 seconds, tell us about your book.
Oh, thank you, Tom. My book is titled A Woman's Home Health Companion, and men, you can read it too, because the information applies to both. Subtitled A Guide to Wellness, and I wrote it trying to break things down in simple steps that you can do every day. It's available on Amazon, it's available in Kindle form, it's available on my website, which is ritastecmd.com.
And that's spelled S-T-E-C.
Yeah, no K.
And I will put both of these websites link on our ACN website, which is acn.cc. Our special guests today on It Seems to Me have been Dr. Rita J. Steck and Jeffrey Bond, and I thank both of you for a vitally important discussion.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Tom Reed on It Seems to Me, and thanks for listening.